this is West Virginia Morning. I'm Glynis Board. This morning, in the only state born of the Civil War, we explore ideas brought about while discussing whether to remove statues that celebrate Confederate Civil War heroes.
I just sort of wonder, okay, what happens after the protest is over? And I think sometimes the power structure just sort of, okay, we'll wait until this blows over and we return to the status quo.
That story and an update on where pipelines and hiking trails intersect coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a victory to the 600-mile Atlantic Coast natural gas pipeline. The issue at hand was whether the U.S. Forest Service could allow the pipeline to be built underneath the iconic Appalachian Trail. To make matters more complicated, the trail is technically managed by the U.S. Park Service. The court's ruling dove deep into the intent of a handful of different federal laws that regulate public lands, but in the end, it ruled that yes, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline can be built under the trail. It's just one high-profile court ruling in a string of lawsuits brought against this and other pipelines. So, just how significant is this win, and what does it mean for the future of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which is behind schedule and has ballooned in cost? And what about other pipelines here in Appalachia? Energy and environment reporter Brittany Patterson spoke with energy analyst and pipeline expert Christy Tizak of Clearview Energy Partners to find out more. Here's part of their conversation.
So what was the issue at the heart of the Supreme Court's ruling?
So the question before the Supreme Court was the Fourth Circuit's decision in December 2018 that found that the Forest Service lacked the authority to give a natural gas pipeline permission to cross the Appalachian Trail at a location that happened to be within the George Washington National Forest.
And what did the Supreme Court find?
Basically, the Fourth Circuit read all of the laws together as indicating that the Appalachian Trail had become part of the Park Service. And as part of the Park Service, the Forest Service couldn't provide permission to cross it. What the Supreme Court found was that the way the statutes that structure the Park Service are set up, the land on which the Appalachian Trail is located within the Forest Service doesn't really transfer its ownership, for lack of a better description, to the Park Service. And therefore, the Forest Service retained the authority to authorize a pipeline to cross beneath it.
Okay, and so does this mean that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is just going to go right back into construction?
Oh, no, because the halt on construction actually has nothing to do with the Appalachian Trail. The important thing about the Appalachian Trail crossing being upheld by the Supreme Court is that it obviates the need for an amendment to the route, and that would have created a whole other set of, changes and comments and approvals and all sorts of things. So it takes away the risk that Atlantic Coast would have to relocate the route. What it does not do, however, is solve the real reason why the pipeline's not under construction. The reason the pipeline is not under construction today is because the Fourth Circuit has vacated not once, but twice, the Endangered Species Act review associated with the pipeline.
There have been a lot of lawsuits, including this one, that have really slowed down pipeline construction, especially of the Mountain Valley Pipeline and Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Is this changing the calculus for companies looking to build future pipelines?
Before Atlantic Coast and Mountain Valley, the suspension and vacator of a permit was actually quite rare. And the change over the last couple of years, we ascribe to the increased sophistication and substance of the challenges brought by pipeline opponents. What has changed, and what changed in particular with Atlantic Coast and Mountain Valley, is how the environmentalists went after the permit. So the ability to actually stop a pipeline in construction wasn't something that was easily achieved. I'd argue it still is a tough thing to manage, but it proved successful with some very solid lawyering on the part of the opposition to really get into the substance of permits issued by federal agencies.
What are the long-term implications of this case?
I think that the Appalachian Trail ruling out of the Supreme Court is an important one, but I think it's only one part of broader trends that surround the challenges facing the construction of new infrastructure, particularly infrastructure that carries conventional fuels like oil and gas. And I think that investors do recognize that the opposition is becoming increasingly more sophisticated, and that the operators that are good at preparing their documentation in federal review, that don't rush the federal regulator to a decision, that execute their obligations under the law the way they need to, are the projects that are most likely to get built. And the ones where, if corners were cut or if I's weren't dotted and T's weren't crossed, for example, in the case of the Forest Service permits for ACP and MVP, where things that should have been addressed were left out, then you can have some pretty significant vulnerabilities. And so I think that there is pressure from the investment community on pipeline sponsors to do good work on the first pass so that their permits do hold up in court, because the challenges to them are improving over time.
That was Christy Tezak, Managing Director with Clearview Energy Partners, an independent research group based in Washington, D.C., speaking with reporter Brittany Patterson. You can follow all our reporting about natural gas pipeline infrastructure at wvpublic.org. West Virginia seceded from Virginia 150 years ago to join the Union and reject the Confederate States of America. It's the only state born from the Civil War. Saturday marked the anniversary of its statehood. But despite that history, Confederate monuments exist across the state. Dave Mistich reports that while some monuments have been toppled or ordered down elsewhere, they remain here in West Virginia. He takes a look at the debate and what some historians say about a galvanizing moment in America as protests over racial injustice continue.
There are 21 statues, memorials, and other markers honoring Confederate generals and soldiers in the state, according to data compiled by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The names of Southern generals and soldiers mark the names of state park resorts, schools, and larger statues tower in public view. Given West Virginia's split from Virginia and thus the Confederacy, memorials to those who fought for the South serve as a historical paradox. One Boston-based historian and educator has an explanation for how they wound up here. Kevin Levin focuses on public memory in the Civil War. He notes that the United Daughters of the Confederacy gave some of the monuments to communities in West Virginia during the Jim Crow era of segregation in the Civil Rights Movement.
We always need to remember that the monuments always reflect the values of the community, the individuals and organizations that erected them and dedicated them originally.
Levin says that most of the efforts to remove monuments have been in larger cities with more diverse populations. But he says, even though statues remain intact here, the fact that West Virginians are even discussing the issue is remarkable.
I think where to look and one way to measure sort of the progress, if you want to call it that, is to look at the places that are even debating this issue.
Much of the conversation here has focused on Thomas Jonathan Stonewall Jackson, a Confederate general who was born in 1824 in present-day Clarksburg, West Virginia. Jackson, who owned six slaves, is memorialized in more than a dozen states and is one of the most recognizable figures of the Civil War. The Harrison County Commission rejected a motion to remove a statue of Jackson that stands in front of the courthouse in downtown Clarksburg. Many who attended the meeting, either in person or virtually, argued that removing the statue of Jackson would be an effort to quote-unquote erase history. Larry Starkey was one resident who spoke against removing the statue.
Where do we let it in? When do we let it in? Are we going to be like everybody else? See people burning because of opinion, because you don't like this or you don't like that? Should we change Robert C. Byrd's name because he was in the KKK at one time? Should we change the Italian festival because Mussolini fought against the United States government? That's all foolishness. You can't change history.
But there were others who called for the statue of General Jackson to be removed, including two men who identified themselves as distant relatives. Colin Grant Jackson called into the meeting from Illinois.
If you want to talk about whose birthright this is and whose opinion should be heard, it seems like I have some qualifications here. I personally believe that this statue does not belong in front of a building that is supposed to be devoted to impartial justice.
Despite the commission voting against removal, some locals and others concerned about the message the statue sends say they'll continue to fight to bring it down. There's an ongoing campaign to lobby members of the commission to reconsider the issue. In Charleston, a bust and statue of Jackson are on display on the grounds of the state capitol. A middle school there, which has the state's highest percentage of black students, bears his name. Bishop Wayne Crozier of Charleston has been part of the effort to rename Stonewall Jackson Middle School.
There is a difference between remembering history and revering history. No one is saying that forget it, but we don't have to act, we don't have to make heroes out of monsters.
Discussions are ongoing about possibly renaming the school after influential black educator Booker T. Washington, Carter G. Woodson, or NASA mathematician Katherine Johnson. Crozier says he's focused on the school because renaming it would be a tangible change that would have lasting impact. He says too often, protests of racial injustice do not bring about significant progress.
A lot of times I just sort of wonder, okay, what happens after the protest is over? And I think sometimes the power structure just sort of, okay, we'll wait until this blows over and we return to the status quo.
While activists push for a more sensitive name for the school, the Kanawha County Board of Education says they will consider the issue at its July 6th meeting. But some board members are pushing back on the idea to rename Stonewall Jackson Middle School. Here's Becky Jordan.
I feel like maybe this is a knee-jerk option that, you know, with all the craziness and the sadness that's happened in our country, that this is a bigger push because, I mean, we've heard mumblings of, you know, some people over the years wanting to change Stonewall, but it never got any energy. It never really got moving.
Some who support memorials to Jackson argue that he should be judged by his respectable deeds, such as conducting a Sunday school for enslaved black people and encouraging their literacy. The American Civil War Museum has said that these facts serve as, quote, a foundation for great misunderstanding in allowing Confederate heritage activists to attempt to distance the South's cause away from slavery. College of Southern Maryland professor of history and West Virginia native Dr. Cicero Fain also says considering figures like Jackson in such a way overlooks a fundamental question in the current debate.
The ultimate barometer by which one should judge a slaveholder is, did he make the ultimate sacrifice and shift away from the economic imperative and instead embrace a moral imperative. And he didn't.
Unlike monuments in other places, those erected in West Virginia have seen no reported vandalism. Fain says he believes statues here will remain standing unless there are dramatic systemic changes, especially with high-ranking public officials mostly mum on the matter.
I don't think the population is sufficient. The black population is sufficient to really bring about significant change without the power brokers, corporate, education, as well as government bringing about having some real hard conversations.
Republican Governor Jim Justice says the memorials at the state capitol are an issue for the legislature to decide, but he's avoided saying whether he wants to see them taken down.
And so from my standpoint, I don't know how to answer it any more plainly than just that. You know, I don't think I have any right to make a decision. I think that's a legislative right. From the standpoint of my personal beliefs, I don't feel like that anyone should feel uncomfortable here. This is our capital. This is our state. This is our people.
But state code gives the authority to decide the fate of the statues on the Capitol grounds to a commission, which the governor partially appoints. As for monuments located elsewhere, those decisions are in the hands of local governments, boards, or maybe, albeit unlikely, protesters themselves. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm your producer and host, Glynis Board.